Hello, Friends Journal readers and listeners and viewers. My name is Gail. I'm the associate editor here at Friends Journal. And today I'm doing an author chat with Stephen McNeil. Hello, Stephen.
Hello.
Good morning to you over there and good afternoon here. Stephen is joining us from
San Francisco, California.
San Francisco, the American Friends Service Committee office there. And Stephen is one of the May issue authors. Here's the May issue on gender and sexuality. And he submitted a piece that is about American Friends Service Committee and their work for LGBTQ rights and recognition, starting all the way back in the 1960s through to today. And we have a beautiful timeline. On pages 24 to 27 of the issue, and there it is. It's really wonderful to see in print. We also have it online as well. Stephen is serves as AFSC's San Francisco Wage Peace Director, and he's been on staff for 32 years, which means he started working on staff in 1984, and before that he served on committees for several years through AFSC. And he's also a member of Strawberry Creek Meeting, so he's a friend as well. So, Stephen, we actually sat down together in Philadelphia back when we were working on this this article together, and you graciously went through everything with me. And it's incredible that we didn't even include everything. We had to leave some of this stuff out.
That's always true.
What?
That's always true. It makes for a better visual as well.
That's true, yeah. So we really wanted to highlight the most important milestones and events here. So the name of the title is, or the name of the article is Proclaiming Love and Justice. So how did you decide on that title? That is actually the title that you submitted to us. How did you pick that?
It's the title of one of the publications that AFSC did under the direction of Kay Whitlock, who lives in Montana, and who was a very active committee member, regional executive secretary in Des Moines, Midwest flood disaster relief recovery director during the time the Mississippi flooded. And she's just been a very pivotal point person in the LGBT movement, especially challenging people's thinking outside the box. For instance, she challenged the idea of adding additional penalties to hate crimes. From a criminal justice perspective, that's not really a just thing to do necessarily. Mm-hmm. Doesn't necessarily lead to any improvement in the administration of justice. And she also, when civil marriage discussions came about, she challenged AFSC and others to think about whether civil marriage was an institution that we would be supporting. So she's really quite creative.
Yeah, and we do have her photo and some of the publications in the timeline as well. In a Time of Broken Bones was one of the papers that she wrote, a call to dialogue on hate violence and the limitations of hate crimes legislation. So that's exactly what you were talking about. And so it seems like she was like working on this like really early on.
And she was that. And the title comes from a board statement during the height of the cultural wars around same-sex and other issues related to LGBT folk. And within the United States, it was a very divisive conversation. And the board statement was one that was trying to be very positive and inclusive.
Okay, wonderful. And so when you came to Philly, you were here for another reason, but I was able to have the opportunity to meet with you in AFSC's, do we have a visitor over there?
That's all right. Yeah, sorry.
That's all right. In AFSC's Philly office, which has the great AFSC archives down in the basement there. And Don Davis was able to pull a lot of old photos and old primary documents for us to sort of sort through and figure out what events and milestones we wanted to include it in the timeline, and also the visuals. So that was really neat to be able to do that. And I was super excited to see the, you sent over to me the 1975 open letter that sort of starts and kicks off AFSC's institutional response to LGBT concerns. So could you tell us a little bit more about what that letter represents? And so you had joined, you had been around, but had joined staff like about 10 years later, but you know about this letter, so.
Right. In fact, I was on a program committee in Washington, D.C. called the Washington Pretrial Justice Committee, which looked at bail reform and other issues on the administration of justice in D.C. jails. Mm-hmm. And so we got the letter when I was at a committee meeting. I went back and looked in our minutes. Okay. And so it prompted a conversation at many different levels within the service committee. And there were basically four people that started it off who were willing to be out at that time was not necessarily a good thing for one's career, one's environment. But it was a very interesting way of doing something by letter, also a very Quaker way of doing something.
Yes, for sure.
And then, so this is the time in Philadelphia anyway of the movement for a new society and the whole reevaluation of what is a new society going to look like and how are we going to deal with oppressions of various kinds, from, you know, minorities to women to LG people and disabled people eventually. So it was had a very positive impact. And I think it was helped along the way by the publication of the British Towards a Quaker View of Sex, mm-hmm. which really is quoted in the article in the beginning, was a very thoughtful piece by weighty friends in Britain, including Keith Wedmore, who lives here in Marin. He was a barrister, and his story was such that he knew of somebody who had committed suicide because of their homosexuality. Mm. So he was very concerned about society's negative impact on individuals.
During that time that he knew somebody, so early 1960s?
It was probably early 1960s, late 50s.
Okay. Yeah, mm-hmm. And that publication that you're referring to was in 1963 was when that came out. And right. Yeah, that made a big impact around, not just for British friends, but American friends too. It reached right. far and wide, yeah.
There were little study circles here and there, including San Francisco, French Channel Conference. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's...
study circles on the panel.
What was that?
There were study circles here in San Francisco and French Journal Conference and other places when it came out.
Okay. And I'm glad that you mentioned it was a very Quakerly thing to do this open letter. I mean, reading it seems very in tune with Quaker process. I just want to read the first paragraph here. So it's dated. Here's the letter printed out that Stephen sent over to me, and it's dated December of 1975, and it starts out, "Dear member of the AFSC family, attached you will find," so this is sort of the cover letter to the actual open letter signed by the four people, "attached you will find a statement of support and solidarity for gay people within the AFSC family, which has been discussed by Staff Concerns Committee and is being circulated throughout the entire AFSC. We see this initial distribution as the beginning of a process," and that is underlined, "of education, conscientious raising, and honest and searching self-criticism, as well as an act of immediate solidarity and concern for the gay community." I think that's really wonderfully written and definitely speaks to Quaker process and the emphasis on thoughtfulness and conscious raising. And then it's also revealed that this has been discussed by Staff Concerns Committee. So it's already sort of been internally vetted before expanding it out to the AFSC family.
That's right. It's on letterhead, which makes it official.
Yes, exactly. True. Yeah, and it goes on to sort of suggest possibilities or encouraging people to talk about this topic within all of their own individual offices and possibilities for procedures. They have a little short list here: discussion at staff meetings, program and executive committee meetings as a special agenda item. So just giving little ideas of how to start talking about this within whatever community you're a part of. Invitations to local gay activists and groups to speak. That speaks to, you know, building relationships, getting to know people that are part of this community. Discussion by staff and small groups. Obtaining literature for office literature, literature racks or displays. Contacting gay caucus members of religious denominations. So all really simple yet forward-thinking, forward-moving ideas. So another thing I wanted to talk about is, so when you came on board in 1984, that was at the San Francisco office, right?
That's correct. I applied for an administrative assistant position with the executive secretary, who was Tony Henry, who is an openly gay Black man who had served on the staff of Martin Luther King Jr.
Oh, wow.
And so he was really quite a persona. And I remember in my interview, technically and legally, you're not supposed to ask about people's sexual orientation. So I was being interviewed by Yasuko Fujita, who was the office manager, and Tony Henry. And they asked me about my position of being a support staff person in an organization where civil disobedience and demonstrations and risk of arrest were sometimes occurring. How did I see myself in that role? Not going out and getting arrested and not being able to do administrative support work. Mm-hmm. So I said I was comfortable. I had been at the National Democratic Convention in San Francisco a couple of weeks before when there was a huge demonstration, and I didn't risk arrest, and I just felt comfortable being there as a witness rather than as a participant in civil disobedience. And so Yasuko knew that the group that was risking arrest was gay, lesbian people. So she asked me, was I gay? And immediately, you know, Tony said, oh, no, you can't ask that.
You can't ask that,
You can't ask that question. But anyway, it came across that way. So it's the first job that I ever been at where being comfortable with being openly gay was a given.
Yeah. And so San Francisco sticks out because they were one of the local program offices that had one of the first that had targeted work around LGBT right. concerns. So when did that sort of start?
Well, it started in the 60s with the Madison Society and the Daughters of Bilitis group, which was a women's group that Phyllis Lyon and Dale Martin started. And they all became friends, Don Lucas from the Madison Society, with Jan Marinissen, who was a Dutch transplant to the Bay Area, who was head of our criminal justice program. And his passion was, he saw all these people in jails and prison that were in there for social behavior, so-called crimes. And so he worked a lot on how to decriminalize crimes against homosexuals, drug use, and mental illness as well. So he was sort of a pioneer in that way. So I don't think he was particularly, other than being Dutch and open-minded, I don't think he was particularly pro-gay or lesbian. He just thought it was stupid that people were being sent to jail for crimes which they really were not guilty.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And you guys have, so some of the other local programs that early on got startup funding were Seattle, Washington, and Portland, Oregon, which is also over on the West Coast. So did you guys ever talk with them or work with them on these issues, like together? Did you collaborate?
Yeah, we did collaborate, especially there every few years there's a gathering of committee volunteers and staff and straight allies that would work on what was the priority issues that we should be both educating ourselves and doing activities and program work on. So no, we had lots of contact. For instance, the Seattle program worked heavily with youth and on the street and LGBT individuals in the middle class and so on. And they they had an intern who came and stayed with us down in San Francisco for a summer, and she was transitioning. And he eventually fully transitioned and was very influential in people within the organization pushing for healthcare, full healthcare coverage for transgender people.
Okay.
So there was lots of interactions here and there, and we all met and traveled together from time to time.
That's great. And the other event I wanted to point out, since I know that you were there, is the March on Washington for LGBT Equal Rights and Liberation, which happened in April of 1993. And we have an awesome photo there in the on the timeline. And when I was asking Stephen questions about this event and making sure I had the name right, he goes, oh, yes, I was there for AFSC. So you were there as part of AFSC, right? And then the other group was Friends for Lesbian and Gay Concerns.
Right. And that's a loose group of Religious Society of Friends who have a midwinter gathering, and then they have usually another gathering at the French General Conference where their business meetings and meetings for worship are well attended by everybody because they're always usually covered and really quite spiritually centered. It's a long tradition at French General Conference.
Yeah. So what was it like being there? Do you have any memories of that event?
Well, my memories are much more personal than they are about the march itself. Mm-hmm. My parents, it was time for my parents to meet my husband, and who came with me to Washington, and we met up in a restaurant called Annie's Paramount Steakhouse in near DuPont Circle, a sort of at that point very gay neighborhood. And my parents are very working class and not college educated, but not dumb. Mm. And so we were all sitting in the restaurant eating, and everybody had come into the city for the march. So there were supposedly something like six thousand, I think, San Franciscans, Bay Area San Franciscans there. So people kept on coming up to the table and introducing themselves and saying hello to my husband, Brian. And so at one point, my mother turns to me and says, how does Brian know all these people? And my stepfather said, shut up, Mary. So it was a nice moment. They were very accepting.
Yeah.
They were wondering. Her only concern was he cooks with herbs. And
that's funny. Know. That's a good story.
Anyway. Yeah, but it was a great moment. It was, again, at the time of the Cultural Wars, and so people needed affirmation and coming together in order to feel right.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And so that sort of brings me up to more present day. So around 2008, the economic downturn was in full force. And by 2010... that right? Yeah. By 2010, the Seattle program was the last U.S. regional LGBTQ program to close down. So AFSC as an institution has less of a focus on this work, but that's not necessarily because they're neglecting it. It's more that we've come a long way. We've made a lot of progress, and it's not as needed anymore to have this as focused work.
And so I was definitely putting a positive spin on the article and the timeline, but my main concern about, yes, I'm sure way will open for AFSC to respond to felt needs and problems as they occur both here in the U.S. and overseas. But the real contribution that AFSC has had over time is to reach out to people and communities across race and class and gender. And so I think that's still needed, that there is a stratification within the gay and lesbian community. Mm-hmm. The movement itself sometimes neglects the issues of class, race, peace, and justice. And so it's important that occur. I'm very heartened by the recent reactions to transgender rights by the business community, which recognizes the need to have an inclusive workforce and communities in which their workers will feel comfortable. but it does take a lot of effort and pain and suffering on some individuals to get us to where we are.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, the phone you hear is the GI Rights Hotline.
Oh, is it?
I'm in their office because it's the quietest office. And so,
oh, okay. Is that with Quaker House in Fayetteville?
Well, they're one of the nodes, yeah. So there are about 12 nodes in the U.S. and Hawaii and Germany, and they're answered by volunteers. And so we have about 8 volunteers that come into this office on a daily basis and get the calls and counsel AWOL family members and people in the military that are having problems.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I mean, I just didn't realize that it makes sense, but I didn't realize that there were phones all over the country where the volunteers are. They don't have to be in Fayetteville. So.
Right.
Wow, that makes sense. Well, you know, we have an author chat with the two executive directors, I guess, of Quaker House, Lynn and Steve Newsom. So that's funny that that happened.
You're going to be here this weekend in San Francisco because the GI Rights Network is coming together for a national meeting.
Oh, great. Okay, cool. Wonderful. Quaker organizations working together. All right, Stephen. Well, that sounds like a good ending point there. Did you have anything else to say?
No. I think I appreciate the time, and I hope people, if they have questions, they can always email me, smcneil@afsc.org. But check out the links in the article, especially towards Quaker View of Sex and Lavashi Vaid's wonderful publication on the LGBT movement today.
Yes, those are two things on the timeline, and we do have links to the online exhibit that was put together for the Towards a Quaker View of Sex, and what was the name of the author of that book?
Urvashi Vaid.
Yes, and her book. You guys over in San Francisco interviewed her and did a review of the book, right? Yeah. So we'll link to that as well.
Mm-hmm. All right.
All right. Wonderful. So thanks so much for talking with me. Viewers can check out Stephen's article and timeline in the May issue of French Journal on gender and sexuality. All right. Thanks so much, Stephen. Bye-bye.
See you again. Bye.